Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, sponsored by 1-800-DIALDJs.com and recorded live on blogtalkradio.com from the new media capital of the world and hometown of comedians Tommy Blaze and Ron Bennington, Tampa Bay. Here are my top 10 reasons for inviting Bill Scheff to be a guest on Mr. Media Radio. Number 10, used to write for ESPN the magazine and left it off the flap of his new book. Number 9, wrote a book, Everything Hurts, which reminds me of that old joke where the guy says to his doctor, "Doctor, doctor, it hurts when I do this." And the doctor says, "Oh, wait, you've already heard this one, huh? Okay." All right, number 8, got Larry David to write a blurb for his book jacket. Number 7, makes his living writing for The Late Show with David Letterman, which gives me the opportunity to write my own hackneyed top 10 list. Number 6, got to keep his staff job on the show despite extorting $50,000 from Paul Schaefer for a tell-all book he proposed calling We'll Be Here for the Rest of Our Lives, a Swinging Showbiz Saga, only to find Paul already wrote the book with David Fitz. By the way, it's now available for $15.21 on Amazon.com. Oh, excuse me. I'm getting a call on the other line. It's Bill's publicist. Hello? What? What? I can't ask Bill questions about the Letterman show? But I'm in the middle of the introduction right now. You know, I'm doing one of those top 10 lists. What? You don't think that's a very original idea? Okay, well, I'm already halfway through. No, all right, fine. Fine, thanks. Goodbye. As I was saying, Bill Scheff is the author of a funny new novel titled Everything Hurts. The publisher calls it a novel, anyway. Reads to me more like a Romana Clef. This is his third novel. The first two were The Ringer and Time Won't Let Me. Bill, welcome to Mr. Media.
Well, thank you so much, and you can keep going with the top 10 list. I'm not, you know, far be it from me to censor, and thanks for making my publicist the bad guy in this. I appreciate that. Thank you for having me on the show.
My pleasure. My pleasure. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. We're in a dark week from the show, which we do after Thanksgiving. So that's always nice and kind of. Rejuice the batteries, as it were, and work on another novel, which I started about a year ago. So, you know, that's nice. I mean, that's I'm very happy. I have a good life.
Now, Bill, I have to be honest. I didn't mean it as a social nicety. I mean, really, how are you? I'm reading this book, and I'm concerned about you.
Well, you shouldn't be, because the thing about this book is that it is it's born of personal experience. There is a happy ending, and I wrote this book. This is a book about a guy trying to get rid of a psychosomatic limp, something we've all experienced. And and I started writing the book years ago. Because I was in constant pain. I was walking around with this limp for about a year, and it had baffled doctors. All my x-rays and MRIs were clean, and the symptomatology had moved around, and nothing stayed the same. And so finally I sought out this this doctor that specialized in psychosomatic pain, because I kind of matched up with, you know, some, i.e. crazy. And I started seeing this doctor, and his program was, you know, he believes that pain is caused by unconscious rage, which is trying to drive toward the conscious mind. And your conscious mind is so threatened by this that it tries to distract you with pain by giving pain to a vulnerable part of your body. So it made sense to me. So I adopted this guy's program, and early on, and of course the program is to look at your past and things in your past that might contribute to this reservoir of unconscious rage. So early on I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to write a book, a novel, about a guy trying to get rid of a psychosomatic limp and try and art myself out of the pain. And that way I'll be doing the guy's program and I'll be writing another book. And so 2 years later, son of a bitch, the book is finished, and the guy in the book is better. The guy in the book is fine. I'm still limping and in constant pain. And 10 days after I was lucky enough to sell the book to Simon & Schuster, I go see yet another doctor and show him my x-ray once again, and he takes one look at it, and he says, you need a hip replacement. I'm not telling you you should get one. I'm telling you you have to get one. This is a no-brainer, and you'll be completely out of pain. And so I did, a year ago, last July, got my hip replaced. I'm proud to say, completely out of pain, walk like a guy that walked normally his whole life. And I tell people the story, and they all say the same thing. Aren't you furious that you were in this pain for 3.5 years that you walked with a limp? And I always say the same thing. You know, if I hadn't, I wouldn't have gotten the book out of it. And so, you know, I suffered for my art. So, but I'm good.
That is so sad in so many ways.
Yeah, well, that's me, yeah. I'm sad in so many ways.
And, you know, by some weird coincidence this morning, I heard Howie Mandel on Howard Stern talking about all of his real and imagined aches and pains. And he was talking about, and I'm laughing, but it's not funny. I mean, he was talking about how, you know, for years he'd have all these symptoms and think he was having a heart attack, and he was never having a heart attack. And then one day he really did have a heart attack, and
It's funny that you mentioned those two people, because I had Howie in mind. There's a little section in my book where there's where the main character Phil Campy starts seeing this guru, Samuel Brun, his daughter, and she sees patients, and one of the patients she sees carries around the little bottle of Purell and the giant bottle of Purell, and the giant bottle of Purell is used to clean the little bottle of Purell. And I thought of Howie when I wrote that. And in terms of Howard, you know, Howard Stern is an absolute devotee of John Sarno, the doctor on whom my character, Samuel Brun, was based, who was the main proponent of psychogenic pain management. And, I mean, he cured Howard of his back pain. And so there's no... Everything is connected, you know. There are no coincidences. But meanwhile, that said, Howie is out of his friggin' mind. there is no book or cure for what is wrong with Howie.
Well, I wanted to ask you. I mean, is this the true valley from which great comedy arises? All this real and imagined pain?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, I was a stand-up comic for 13 years, and I think that most good comics, become comics to escape the pain they either grew up with, real or imagined, and I think that that is the source of great comedy. I believe that. And it also, out of pain, I think that true pathos can emerge. And my books have, in addition to a lot of laughs, my books have what I like to call, you know, pathos up the yin-yang, which I have to run down to the copyright place and renew my copyright on that expression. But,
up the yin-yang. That's where the pathos really hurts.
That's right. But it's, you know, this is a book for anyone that has ever, you know, put their hand on their lower back and thought, was that a twinge or is it just gas? I mean, because you don't know, because none of us know what is real and what is, you know, what is coming out of, you know, that circus tent that is our brain, that is our mind.
Now, have you had any subsequent big health issues like that, since getting the hip dealt with, where you've been?
Well, you know, it's funny it's funny that you mentioned that, because the other day, and most people that get their hip replaced if they have a congenital defect, like I had. First of all, I mean, I should have known, because my younger brother had his hip replaced at 36 and had his second one done 4 days after me. My mother had her hip replaced, and my older brother had his hip replaced last summer. So, you know, you have to know it's in the family. And but most people that have the defect that I have, which is dysplasia, which is usually found in like a cocker spaniel or something like that, where the hip joint isn't the ball is not quite in the socket. It's a little off, and it creates all kinds of arthritis and all kinds of other fun stuff. And eventually you need to get the other one done, because it just happens that way. So, you know, I'm fine. I'm running around. I'm springing along. And all of a sudden I get the twinge in the other side, and it's like, oh, my God, here we go again.
Oh,
meanwhile,
no.
My doctor said to me, the right is, you got a lot of miles left on the right. And it turns out that what I just have in the right side is just simple bursitis, because, you know, it did so much of the heavy lifting for so long. So it's so wonderful to have something wrong with you, put ice on it for 20 minutes and it goes away. I mean, this is a dream. I mean, for a 52-year-old Jew in New York, this is a dream. To just put ice on it and it goes away. So I'm good. I'm good.
Well, so not that I spoke to him directly, of course, but Larry David apparently identified with your character, Phil Camp, a.k.a. Marty Fleck, a.k.a. Bill Schaff.
Yeah.
Excuse me. How do you – I mean, Larry doesn't do a whole lot outside of his own show. How do you get a Larry David to write a blurb for your book?
I know Larry for 25 years. We were stand-ups together. We were good friends. He's also been very generous. He blurbed my first novel, The Ringer. He also blurbed my collection of Sports Illustrated columns. So he's been, you know, he's been very generous to me, and he's a big supporter of my writing. And you know, with Larry, if you know him and if you're a friend of his, I mean, he doesn't turn down too much from his friends, and that, you know, that separates him from just about everybody else that has reached his level of success. But I will say this about Larry, you know, knowing him for as long as I have, you know how, and everybody does this, you know, you're out at dinner and or you're somewhere with other people and something weird happens and somebody will say, you know, this is just like an episode of Seinfeld, and everybody will laugh. And, you know, it's not. I mean, I wasn't there, but it's not. The thing about Larry is, when you hang around with Larry, you never know when a scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm is going to break out. And I'll just tell you this one story. A couple of years ago, we're having dinner in New York, and we reach the end of the meal, and I say to him, how about some dessert? And he says, no dessert for me. Ted Danson and I have a bet. No dessert for a year. So I'm thinking, wow, it's Larry David. It's Ted Danson. They're both billionaires. The bet is no dessert for a year. The bet has got to be $50,000, $100,000. The bet, it might be $1 million. The bet's probably $1 million. So I say to Larry very excitedly, how much is the bet for? He says, $200. I said, have a piece of friggin' cake. I mean, this is the guy. This is he. You know, as much as he tries to distance himself from the character he plays on screen, he will never succeed in that. As much as he succeeded in the rest of his life, he will never succeed in convincing people that is some different guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like I've learned more about him in the last week than maybe in the last couple of years from your story and your friendship with him. And then my wife and I over Thanksgiving caught a repeat of him appearing on Joy Behar's Headline News show. And I guess they go back to the same period of time of doing stand-up.
Well,
and you could see that relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing about, Joy had a short-lived talk show on I want to say maybe USA, or it was one of the free cable. I think it was USA. I can't remember. But Larry joined the show early on as a kind of writer, producer, and this is well before Seinfeld. And of course, you know, Larry was there like 3 weeks, and I remember this. And then the next thing he says, you know, I'm thinking of being on camera on the Joy Show. I said, what are you going to do? He was so excited. He said, I get to wear a toupee and pretend I'm a producer. And it was, he would just be in these cold opens with a young woman named Susie Sorrow, who was a comic, and you will know her from Seinfeld. She was the chocolate babka woman that gets in the fight with Elaine. She's blonde. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's very you can't miss her. And she was also on the show. I think she was the warm-up comic for the show, and it was all about Larry as this very lascivious producer, you know, trying to convince her that he could get her on the show. I mean, and every cold open was the same. And I don't remember what was said. It's really not important. You just could not take your eye off this toupee that he wore. And he loved wearing it. And I think that, like everything else with Larry, you know, nothing is thrown out. I mean, he's like a mulcher. You know, that, I think, inspired the episode of Seinfeld where George gets the toupee. So, you know, believe me, nothing gets thrown out.
I hear you.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you. You write in Everything Hurts that it took your lead character Phil Camp roughly a month, maybe two, to write his first book. And I kind of wondered, are you that fast? Can you knock one of these out like so much jump change?
Well, first of all, the book that Phil Camp, in order to settle his divorce, he decides he's going to write this parody of a self-help book called Where Can I Stow My Baggage? And he writes the thing. It's like 10,000 words or 20,000, and he writes it writes it in 2 months, and he writes it as a joke. It's a goof, and the world takes it seriously, and he becomes this self-help guru. I am absolutely not that fast. I'm a fast joke writer, and I was when I was a newspaper writer, when I was a sports writer, I was very fast, and I was enamored of my own speed. But when it comes to writing novels, everything slows down. And it takes me it takes me at least 2 years to write the first draft of a novel. Usually maybe a little longer, but every type of writing requires a different set of muscles. So when you're writing monologue jokes for Dave, you know, you're using those quick twitch muscles like they refer to with, you know, sprinters, where it's just, you know, it's just meatball surgery. You're just making mounds and mounds of coleslaw, and you're just firing over and over, trying to get as many different takes on the same premise as you can. With, you know, with fiction, everything has to slow down because you have to get in a state of mind where you're inhabiting these characters and these situations. And so it's very different. But good question, though.
Thanks. Let me make a note of that because I want to ask that of somebody else next. I want to repeat that one. Do you remember the first thing you ever wrote that someone thought was funny?
Well, I remember. You can answer that question at different times of your life. I remember if you ask my mother, the first funny thing I said, I was three, and we were at the barber shop, and I was waiting. And I had very long eyelashes when I was a kid. And a woman sitting next to me said, "What lovely long eyelashes. Do you use mascara?" And I said, "No, Noxzema." And my mother, you know, "Oh, I have a genius. You know, he's saying Noxzema at three." And so if you ask my mother, that's what she'll say. And please don't ask my mother. And if I think about the first joke that I wrote for Dave that he did on the air was 1991, and the joke was, well, Elizabeth Taylor and her new husband Larry Fortensky had their first fight. It was over whether or not he should unpack. So that was the first joke I wrote for Dave, and I think the first joke the first original joke I wrote as a stand-up, and I did what a lot of guys do when they're starting stand-up. I decided that it would be best to be very self-deprecating, and you know, but it doesn't really fly when you're like 22 and you're young and you're cocky. It doesn't, you know, and unjustifiably cocky. In the first, but this joke used to get a laugh. I used to do a joke about how I went to a massage parlor and they asked me if I wanted a child's portion, and that was the first original joke ever, which is pretty good. That was not bad.
Good.
But I, you know, so those are three answers that I gave you. Pick one.
Good. Well, I'll go with number two. How did it make you feel that you could make people laugh, and you know, did it change your perception of self over time?
Boy, that's a great question. I think that what happens is, when you find out you're funny, when somebody tells you you're funny, when you discover that you're funny, it's your go-to move to get in and out of a lot of situations. And if you find this out about yourself young, you will absolutely abuse it and it won't work. And you'll be, you know, you're going to get into trouble. You're going to get, you know, sent to the principal's office. You know, things are going to happen to you. But I think that the earlier you find out you're funny and the more you pay attention to it, I think that the better you get at what you do. And I think over the years, I got more respectful of the fact that I could do it. I just didn't want to be sloppy. You know, I don't want to get on the couch here, but you know, really it's all about approval, right? Because once you make somebody laugh, you know, is there any quicker approval than making somebody laugh? You know, with me, it starts where somebody once said that people become comics like women become hookers, right? They do it for like one person, and then they do it for a few people, and then they find out they're good enough to get paid at it. And that's how I became a stand-up. And basically, it was, you know, how to get the most immediate approval from the largest group of people. Now, what I didn't count on is that it don't always happen. And the inconsistency of the response, I could never deal with that. So I did it for 13 years because it was how I made a living, but I always just wanted to be a writer. And this leads me into my next hilarious story, which I hope you think is hilarious, which is the thing is, when I stopped doing stand-up and I was just a comedy writer. But the thing is that just because you're not, you don't get to hear the immediate response to something, whether, you know, people get it or not, it doesn't mean people stop not getting it. So I'll give you this example. I wrote a piece for George Magazine in 1997 or 98, and it was a humor essay, and the essay was a conspiracist view of American history in 600 words, okay? And back then, everybody at George Magazine was a 23-year-old girl who had either just finished having sex with JFK Jr. or was about to have sex with JFK Jr. So I turn this piece in, and I get a call from a woman, you know, like, hello, this is Dee Dee the fact checker. You know, hi, Dee Dee. Okay, I just finished your piece. I said, okay. She says, I just have one question. I said, okay. She says, is it a known documented fact that John Hancock died without life insurance? And I said, Dee Dee, honey, that's a joke. And, okay, you know, so it really, the chance that people won't get it, that never goes away. There's always that possibility.
Oh, man. Now, see, when we get done, I'm going to go out to the garage where I have my box of George magazines. I have the whole set, and I have my box of Spy magazines from that set. And now I'm going to go back through the Georges, and I'm going to find that and read that.
There was that piece. I think I did three for George. And I did there was a piece after that, which I really liked, which was the all-purpose concession speech. And it was that was pretty good. That I remember. And there was one other
too,
but there was But it was I put a lot of good magazines out of business. I wrote a humor piece for Talk magazine called Ron Perlman's Thank You Notes after he got married to Ellen Barkin. I mean, come on, really? Do we really need that? Yes, we do.
Well, at least I hope you got paid by the word, because I imagine it was pretty short.
It was it's your standard. It was your standard, thousand word thing. And I was lucky enough to write get a couple pieces in the New Yorker back then, where I still kind of liked what they were doing in terms of those pieces. And I'll just tell you this: do we have time for another story from 11 years ago?
Can you go a few minutes over, or do you have
sure?
To
oh yeah,
right
sure, in? Sure, sure.
Oh yeah, we can keep talking then. I'm fine.
Yeah.
Sure.
So I wrote this piece for Shouts and Murmurs called Jerry Springer's Voicemail, and it was based at the height of Jerry Springer's popularity, and he went on Larry King and he said, "I get 5,000 calls a day of people that want to be on my show." So I thought, "Oh, this is great. I can just do his voicemail." And so there were all these, everything was like, "Hello, Jerry. Does your show still do makeovers? My son is a Nazi skinhead, and I would like him to be a Republican congressman. He's a 44. He's a 44 Husky." It was like it was all like that. So the piece comes out. The day after the piece comes out, I get a call from New Yorker. They say there is a guy. He is desperately trying to get in touch with you. So I say, great. I give him my home number. The guy calls me and he says to me, "Hi, do you know me?" I said, "No, you called me." He says, "Look, I just read your piece in the New Yorker, and I noticed that you used the name Martin Resnick." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, that's my father-in-law's name." I said, "Wow, what a coincidence." I said, "What can I tell you? I like the name Resnick." He says, no, wait a minute, hear me out here. And also, the issue is dated March 9th, which is my wife and my wedding anniversary. So I just want to know, did you do this whole thing as kind of a tribute and a present to me and my wife? I say to him, "Look, I don't know you. I've never met you. I like the name Resnick." Long pause. The guy realizes now that perhaps he's been a little grandiose. He then says to me, "So, what are you, like a writer?" That's it. I say, "You're going to hear a sound. It's going to sound like me hanging up, but just keep talking."
Right, right. I think I've seen that line in a book somewhere now.
Yeah.
I believe the former Mrs. Camp uses that.
That's
line.
Right. Oh, that's right. Oh, very good. Yeah, that's right. Jeez. Yeah. Well, not only Larry David, but nothing goes to waste with me.
Well, I don't know where I came to this, but as you were telling that Resnick story, I just finished. I make my living writing books with like CEOs or people that have stories to tell. So I just finished this book with a criminal profiler, and the last chapter of the book, we went through after it was all written. And it's stories of people who've been murdered, and
right.
I mean, serious stuff. But we had to go through and change all the names to protect both the innocent and the guilty, and not get sued.
Right.
And I realized after I sent the legal changes and the copy edited version in yesterday, that there's a double homicide in the last chapter, and it occurred to me that. The first names that we had changed to were Bob and Christine, my name and my wife's
name. Oh, that's
name.
Great.
And I'm just, I can't, it's too late. I can't call it back. And I'm the second author on it, but I'm just thinking, oh my God, I just had my wife and I killed in a double homicide.
But that, you know, well, that's all. I mean, yeah, she's fine with that. I haven't even met her, and she's fine with that. You know, it's funny. My first book, The Ringer, which was I had a character in it based on my uncle, the great New Yorker writer Herbert Warren Wynne, and my mom reads the book and calls me in galleys and calls me, and she said I love the book. She said, you got a lot of real stuff in here. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, you got his real address. Well, you know, when you're writing a book, you don't think it's going to get published. You know, you're just writing it. And
right.
I had his exact address in Manhattan. So luckily I had enough time to move him down a couple of blocks. But yeah, that happens.
Jeez. No, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the sports writing stuff.
Yes, sure.
I think most people, you know, when you write for TV, you're not really credited, so people know exactly what you've written. But when you're writing for ESPN the magazine, Sports Illustrated, I think a lot of people still recognize your name from those publications. But my experience over the years, having written a couple of sports books and some humor stuff, and is that those two don't necessarily mix well. I'm kind of wondering how you found a way to, you know, make another career out of that.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure how that happened either. But I was a legit sports writer when I got out of college for a couple of years, and I did a lot of sports humor in my stand-up act. So okay, fine. So then I start working at Letterman for a while, and I always, after I'd been working there for a few years, I thought, you know, this would be a great idea for a syndicated newspaper column, to just have a column called The Monologue, and three times a week, you know, do a 20 to 25 joke monologue about current events, because I was writing 50, 60 jokes a day for Dave, and, you know, very little, you know, gets on. I mean, that's just the nature of late night television. You just churn out a lot of material. And so then I get a call from ESPN magazine, because I knew a couple of the guys from Sports Illustrated, and Tony Kornheiser was leaving as a columnist there, and they were looking for another columnist. And I had written a couple of comedy pieces for the Sunday New York Times sports section, of course, that great bastion of humor. But they were single concept pieces. So they called me and they said, would you, you know, we have an opening for a columnist. I mean, I couldn't believe this is 20 years after I gave up my dream of being a sports writer. And I said, well, I have this idea for a column. It would be called The Monologue, and it would just be all sports topical jokes about sports. And they're looking at me like, well, how many jokes? I said, well, I said, it's an 800-word column, probably 20, 25 jokes. And they said, well, how can you possibly do that? I said, well, I write 50 or 60 jokes a day for Letterman. So once they saw that I could actually churn out the raw material, and I always wrote long because, you know, jokes are just modular pieces. So I would always write 30 from which they could cut 10. You know, I'd always give my editors plenty of stuff to cut, which they love. And they saw immediately that it was possible to do this. So I worked there for 2.5 years, and then Sports Illustrated said, do you think you can do this every week? And I went, yeah. And that's what happened. But the funny thing that you mentioned about, that's really the only time that my name has been on the door, so to speak, that it was, you know, that I was the front man for the material I was writing. And let me tell you something. I never anticipated the less than stellar mail that I would receive. Never anticipated.
That's what I wanted to ask you about.
And it's right. And that was one of the things that I wanted to do in this book, was talk about, deal with the mail that a columnist gets, which is why I did that with Phil and Marty Fleck. And that line from John Alter up front, he actually said that to me. He said, you know, when you write a column, you wear and you take shots at people, you wear a big sign on your back that says, kick me. And he really put that into perspective. Yeah, and so early on, when I didn't know what this book was going to be about, I really wanted to write a book about a guy who got hate mail, as a columnist who got hate mail. I wanted that to be an element. in the book. And that's one thing I don't miss about not having a column anymore.
Well, and I also kind of imagine that even on the staff, that there were probably two camps at both magazines, those that really liked what you did and those just didn't think it was appropriate to be making fun of sports and athletes.
You know, I think that at the magazine, I had a lot of support at both magazines from the editors. There was some envy from other writers, which I understood because I am the guy in his underwear in the basement, writing. But the thing is that I like to think that I did it with enough wit and sophistication that it wasn't gratuitous. But I had and I also got read a lot. I mean, because the column was so accessible, it was so easy to digest, and you could sort of take it or leave it. I did really well at both magazines. But yeah, it was. Yeah, I guess it was not traditional sports writing at all, but I never, claimed, I was never, necessarily being a journalist except in the way that I presented the fact before I made the joke. That I felt very responsible about. But, now, of course, I mean, I did not create this, but, look at everything you read. I mean, Every site on the internet has just a guy cracking wise. I mean, that's what it is now. But I never looked at it as opinion. I never looked at it. It was, I prided myself in the fact that that column at Sports Illustrated, like Johnny Carson, you never knew how I felt about teams or, you could never tell who I was a fan of or who I wasn't a fan of because I was an equal opportunity knocker.
Mm-hmm.
I hope.
Absolutely. And is it ever frustrating? Now, so you go from that, and I got it backwards. I thought you were doing that, and then you started with TV. I didn't realize how long you'd been doing.
I've been at Dave since 91.
Okay.
I was there the last 2 years of NBC.
Okay. Is it ever frustrating writing for TV where the audience never knows what you wrote?
Is it? I think that if you think about it, it is. But I think that if you accept that that's what television is that there's so much stuff that doesn't get on the air because you're just, like I said, you're making mounds and mounds of coleslaw to get one good serving, and ultimately, you are signing up to the taste of the host and. He takes some stuff. He doesn't take some. I'm telling you, I'm there 18 years, and if I hold up a page of 10 jokes, and I say he's definitely going to take these two, and he definitely won't take these two, and the other six I have no idea about, I'll get that page back, and invariably, he's taken one of the two that I never thought he'd take. And neither one's of the ones that I guaranteed myself that he would take. And ultimately, he's made the right decision for him. So it's just service is what it is.
Right. So me at home, I don't know what you've written and someone else has written. But I mean, you're getting paid by Worldwide Pants, I assume. And
right.
Dave knows what you've written. And that's really all that matters at that point.
Right. And the other thing is, and this is the global comment that I wrap all this in, is, when I was writing 50 jokes a day, let's say, 50 monologue jokes a day, on a great day, he would take 10, he'd put 10 on cards, and he would end up doing 5 of them in the 8-joke monologue. And like I have to tell you, every day was not a great day. But the thing is whether he takes 50 of 50 or 0 of 50, at the end of the day, you're still a writer. And that's the thing that I've always taken great comfort in, is that it's the results aren't up to me.
Hmm. Well, we'll wrap up in a minute or so. I got to ask a favor, though.
Go ahead.
I want to know if you can pass a message on for me to Paul Schaefer at the show.
Absolutely. Paul, yeah.
Paul, yeah. Tell him I'm very disappointed that he did his book with Rips. I had actually proposed the same book to him 8 years ago.
Is that right?
And yeah, we had a great conference call, and he was ready to go, get this, until he found out I lived in Florida the next day and not in Manhattan.
Well, you
true
know,
story.
That sounds very, very plausible. I got a big kick out of the book, and I'm sorry that it happened that way. And the other thing that writers, we're like fishermen, aren't we? We have a lot of stories of the ones that got away. And I remember when I was a comic, and I got a lot of notes from people in the business. You know, you lean a little too heavily on the word Jew. There's a little too much Jew in the act. And it's like, yeah, okay, fine. And then 5 years after me, another guy comes along by the name of John Stewart, and the act was Jew, 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 and they, you know, they embraced him as the new voice. And that's right, that's right. But I think Paul did a great job with that book,
yeah.
I'm happy that, you know, nobody, look, the best thing you can say about a guy that you know for 20 years is when you read his book, is there anything new in it? And I'm telling you, 80% stories that he has never told me, and I consider him a good friend, and I wouldn't be saying that unless I was incredibly superficial in show business, but he did a nice job, and I'm sorry you missed out, but there'll be another
one. Oh, listen, It all worked out fine. I mentioned that I actually have two great stories that I love to tell. One is the miss with Paul, and then being in the Yankee dugout before a game started and waiting for something. I won't go into the whole story. And then Yogi Berra comes over right before the game starts, and he's like, "Who the fuck are you?"
Oh, that's
I said,
great.
"Well, I'm just covering the story of these kids." Yeah. He says, "What are you doing in my fucking dugout?"
Oh,
well, I'm just gonna get the fuck out of my dugout.
Oh, that's great.
It's those nice, what would they call, what they used to call them on the Letterman show, brushes with celebrity?
Yeah, that's right. Brush with greatness.
Brush with greatness.
Yeah. But, you know, this is the difference between us. I played softball with Yogi Berra's granddaughter, Lindsay Berra, who was a writer at ESPN Magazine. And I'll never forget sitting on the bench the first game and sweet Lindsay Berra looking at me and saying, "God, I got to take a pee." And I just thought, well, there you go. That's right. The genes are still there.
Well, listen, we've kept you over the time.
Well, I had a ball. This was great. I mean, I know, and I am always guilty of this. I did not hump Everything Hurts as much as I should. Look, I'm really proud of this book. You know, I've written three novels. I think that this is my best. You know, there's just a lot there for everybody, and that's all I can say. Please get it.
Well, listen, absolutely, folks. Listen, you can find writer Bill Sheff's new novel, very funny new novel, Everything Hurts, as well as his first two books, The Ringer and Time Won't Let Me, which I always get a song going through my head when I hear that. At your local bookstore, or you can order it online at MrMedia.com.
Right, and I'm here at www.billsheff.com, and we have a lot of fun on my blog, and I will respond to anybody that comments. And there's Larry David stories, there's stories from my my ill-fated past and the wreckage of the future. So, and thank you so much, Bob. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Bill. Good talking to you, and
continue
good luck, and happy holidays.
Thank you. You too. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. And folks, for dozens more interviews with funny people, you can surf over to our main website. That's www.mrmedia.com. That's where you can listen to my earlier conversations with Lisa Lampanelli, Robert Schimmel, Ralphie May, Aziz Ansari, Jason Stewart, Judy Tenuta, Rabbi Bob Alper, Ant, James P. Connolly, Eugene Merman, and Jeff Garlin. And subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. That's A-N-D-E-L-M-A-N. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/Andelman or facebook.com/Andelman. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate when you give up a little piece of your day and spend it with us. Thanks for listening, everybody.